Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello, and welcome to a very special yet somewhat bittersweet edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined as always by my co-host Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. And it's bittersweet, Charlie, because this marks the first time in Cinema Clash history that we are having to reveal our top 10 lists from separate locations without the benefit of watching each other's reactions to our respective picks.
It's not the way I would choose to do it. Usually, about 3 to 4 of your picks just make me look at you just with this utter, just this look of nausea over my face and disgust of what you end up putting on your top 10. But if this is how we have to do it just to do it, that's fine. Just know it's going to have to be audible disgust this time. A point in my favor, though, is a lot this year got postponed. A lot of 2020 releases became 2021 and on releases, especially the tent poles and Marvel films, which you usually stuff your list with. So maybe only one or two of your picks will give me borderline heart attacks.
I don't know, but I'm missing, by the same token, my ability to visibly cringe at some of your picks. And so that really has always been half the fun. And I apologize if you can hear my cat's rattle in the background. She's decided that now is a good time to play.
But, yeah, I can hear the rattle, but you can probably hear the rain hitting my windowsill. It's a rainy New Year's Day, and I'm drinking white wine out of a can, which I think is the 2020 of alcohols, white wine out of a can.
Oh, how low you have had to go, Charlie, in 2021.
Sophia,
so soon.
Blanc de Blancs, Sophia of California.
Wow. Okay. Well, that is a momentous start to the new year, but I think that's a good trigger to reflect back on the year that was, which is a really strange year. And so for my particular list, this is, I think it's important to point out, these are not your typical Oscar pool consideration picks. We'll have that come April of this year. But I decided I was going to construct my list with films that brought something particularly unique to the table or provided a simple spark of joy in the strangest of times. And hopefully we'll have an opportunity to celebrate a few hidden gems as well.
Yeah, I don't feel very confident about my list. 2020 was not a bad year of film, not at all. Even though when we did our podcast of top 5 films I'm most looking forward to, 2 to 3 of mine got bumped. So perhaps, 2 or 3 that would have been on here are not. And I just don't feel as excited about this. I was looking at the list as a whole, and It doesn't blow my hair back, Other years I've been like, yeah, this is the list right here. It's infallible. There can be no criticisms. But here, I could replace anything from 5 on down and feel just fine. I love them all. They're on my 10, but for a reason. But anything from my honorable mentions could jump on it, and I wouldn't shed a tear. I don't care. It's fine. But this is just how it is today.
Yeah, no, I agree. My list really is not, there's not that La La Land or Star is Born, those films that
really
in previous
those
years,
are the ones you're gonna pick.
Well, but there have been films in previous years where I just, and Green Book, where I knew watched it and I knew that this was my favorite film of the year. I don't have that this year at all. These are they're all good, and there were so many more that also were good. But I don't have overwhelming favorites at all this year, because we did see, I looked at my list, over 100, I think I saw 150 films. And even looking to construct the list, I'd forgotten about so many of them, especially when you think pre-pandemic and post, and those final films that we saw in a movie theater. It was really interesting to kind of reflect back and think, where were we even in the midst of of the pandemic, you know, what was our mindset? And that kind of did influence my list.
All right. Well, start putting a smile on my face with your excellent and above board and just beloved picks. What, Hannah, is your number 10?
Well, funny you should say excellent, because my number 10 is Bill and Ted Face the Music, the final installment in a 3-movie arc spanning 3 decades, a movie in which the sole mission was to reward fans of Bill and Ted. Alex Winter's Bill, Keanu Reeves' Ted, they're back, they've got kids, party on, dude. This was a great escape. I will not pretend it was for anyone other than Bill and Ted fans, but for them and us, it delivers, and that counted for a lot.
Yeah, you're throwing me for a loop. That's an odd pick. It was okay. It was all right. It didn't, I never thought it was going to wow me, and it didn't. It's not as good as the first one. It was good to see them again, you know, and they're fathers, and they're doing different stuff, but the same arc, you know, got to get the song, save the world kind of thing. Yeah, it's not a safe pick. I mean, that's the kind of pick, that's a kind of a lightning rod pick. Like, hey, look at my list. This is going to be different. So
it's going to be different. So what's your number 10, Charlie?
It turns out to be a documentary. It's the only documentary on the list. So I guess it's my favorite documentary of the year. Boy State. 1,017-year-old boys from Texas get together in Austin and they have to build their own representative government. And since they're from Texas, there's a lot of very loud, very vocal adoration of the Second Amendment and marriage between a man and a woman. And we get to know, you know, about 4 or 5 of these boys really well. Stephen Garza, Robert McDougall, Ben Feinstein, Renee Otero. Those are names I still remember. We saw this back in May, June, and I still remember these names. And I remember how gut-wrenched I felt at the end. I felt stabbed. I cared about what was going on in this week in Austin, Texas. And it makes you fear the future, and it makes you proud of the future. Like, okay, we're going to be okay, but oh man, we got some work to do with the next generation.
Yeah, I agree. I enjoyed Boy State, and I think it also came out. We watched it at a time that was really in the midst of the election cycle, the presidential race, and so it really had these very strong underpinnings of, oh my gosh, what direction is the country going to go in, not just this year, but further into the future. And I did feel that that it offered some hope in the end, which was nice.
All right, number 9.
Well, my number 9 is, I'm curious to see if you remember this or have it on your list, perhaps, but I gave number 9 to Extraordinary. Remember that one back in March? May have been our final in-person together pre-pandemic podcast, even.
I remember it very well, yeah. Because it made my honorable mention list.
But I, you know, this was to me a film that it practically dares you to like it. Part Ghostbusters, part Ghost Whisperer, a weird romantic comedy element to it, a really good ensemble that included Will Forte as this washed up satanic one-hit wonder. Who had sung this bizarrely captivating tune called Cosmic Woman. It's so hard to explain why this movie works. It just does. And, you know, someday I may even rewatch it, and hopefully someday other people will actually find it.
Yeah, nobody saw Extraordinary but us. And just like, as a coincidence, last week I was looking for Cosmic Woman, the song, because I wanted to listen to it. I never forgot this little movie. It's very Irish. It's got a sci-fi supernatural tint to it, but it's really just like a screwball comedy. The second half just turned straight hysterical. I remember laughing really hard at this film. I don't remember the lead actress's name right now, but she was wonderful. I remember she was wonderful, and I would it's on my honorable mention list. I would love to put this on my top 10. It could be the year's best, one of the year's best comedies. It's a wonderful film.
And that's why my list is sort of that it brought me a spark of joy during this year. And so that's why I want to make sure that some of those movies get elevated on a list, because so many others just sort of seem like kind of typical. But what's your next one there, Charlie?
My number 9 is Sound of Metal, directed by Darius Marder. We're watching Riz Ahmed as a heavy metal drummer whose life is thrown into chaos and freefall, you know, when he begins to lose his hearing. He's in a duo, in a band. The other one is Olivia Cooke. He doesn't know how to handle what's going on. He's freaking out. And, you know, his significant other, Lou, sends him to rehab and recovery for deaf people because she's afraid he will relapse into the drugs that he used to do before they met. And so half this film, or maybe more than half, is his unwillingness to accept, his denial that he is now deaf, and his slow, very slow integration and acceptance into a new cast of society. And it's just a remarkable film.
I agree that it's a remarkable film, so remarkable that there's probably a very good chance that it will appear on my list at some point in the next few minutes. So stay tuned for that. So I will move on to my number 8, which is the first one that will make you normally... What do you hate the most about my lists usually, Charlie?
There's usually some sort of superhero on it.
Well, not only that, but... You also hate when I do ties.
I don't appreciate the tie. You know, this is black and white here. There's no gray. There's no room for gray areas.
So not only do I kill two birds with one stone here, but Birds of Prey is one of them. And the other one that it ties with is The Old Guard. Now, I can tell you, it's not going to be a total spoiler for you to know that I do not have Wonder Woman 1984 on my list, because I found it quite disappointing. But what it made me think about was that there were two better action movies in 2020 with women kicking butt. So Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, and which was in theaters back in February with Margot Robbie as the Joker's crazy ex-girlfriend leading this girl gang into action. And then with The Old Guard, that was a summer surprise for me. Charlize Theron as the leader of a small army of these immortal, centuries-old mercenaries. And that one was a superhero movie, historical fiction, supernatural stuff, a war drama. There was just a whole lot going on, but somehow I really felt that it works. So that's why I am giving Birds of Prey and The Old Guard my superhero pick for 2020.
I think it did this on purpose just to needle me. Both Birds of Prey and The Old Guard are superior to Wonder Woman 1984. It's actually not hard to be better than that film, but neither, I think, rise above average action fare. They're watchable and then they're forgettable, move on. I think I remember The Old Guard a bit more than Birds of Prey just because it was a little bit more unique, but no, I'll pass on both those.
Again, brought me a spark of joy.
Just to mess with me. That's why. That's that your spark.
And I do it to mess with you, to have a tie and superheroes all in one. So what's your number 8?
Number 8 actually has a number in the title, but it's not 8. It's The Trial of the Chicago 7. The story, the mostly true, I believe, story from Aaron Sorkin, who both wrote the adapted screenplay and directed the film. The story of 7 people on trial stemming from various charges surrounding the uprising at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Illinois. An excellent ensemble cast, led by Eddie Redmayne and Sacha Baron Cohen, but very strong supporting performances, especially by Frank Langella, the judge, and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II as Bobby Seale. I like listening to an Aaron Sorkin film. I like the dialogue just wash over me. And I didn't know. I knew there was a Chicago 7, and I knew it was connected to 1968. But that was the extent. I didn't know who or what Abbie Hoffman was and how they were kind of railroaded and how the justice system was tilted on purpose against them by Nixon. So, I learned a lot, and it was superior filmmaking. So all on board for me for The Trial of the Chicago 7.
Yeah, I like that movie too. I would put it in my honorable mentions for the year. I love Aaron Sorkin's dialogue is always good. I remember feeling that it, I don't know if it dragged at certain points, like the pacing kind of went a little off for me in the middle, but it certainly was a more engaging courtroom drama than we would often otherwise get. So Chicago 7 is a good one. And speaking of 7, I'll move on to my number 7 pick, which I don't know if you ever actually did see it, The Broken Hearts Gallery. And this came out in September, but I think only in theaters, so nobody saw it. I couldn't even remember exactly who was in it, but just that I remember needing this particular romantic dramedy after we were subjected to a string of really, really lame ones. And so the Broken Hearts Gallery was funny, smart, a satisfying meet cute. And it was about this pop-up gallery that featured a collection of keepsakes from failed relationships. And it resulted in this social media movement that brought people together. And the Broken Hearts Gallery is just a hidden gem that is a romantic dramedy that we haven't had many good ones. And this was really, really well done, engaging, and worth finding.
I have not seen the Broken Hearts Gallery, but the handful of people who have, especially on Twitter, are very vocal about their love for it. Friend of the program, Nell Minow, I believe also loves that movie. She likes to name drop it when people are saying, hey, what's something I need to watch that I've never heard of? And that frequently comes up in her recommendations. Yeah, a lot of people have a lot of love for that little film.
Yep, it's a hidden gem. What's your seven?
My number seven is also, like Chicago 7, set in Chicago, but not in 1968. It's set in 1927. I'm talking about Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, the second adaptation of an August Wilson American Century play. This time it's Chadwick Boseman in his final performance and Viola Davis heading the cast. Another strong ensemble piece. There's tension rising between Ma Rainey and her, what you would call an ambitious horn player. And a studio session that takes place in just in a couple hours and during one day that they're recording music for this white management. And I loved, you know, a lot of people say, but it's based on a play and it feels like a play. I don't think that necessarily should hurt a film. It works just fine for me. I loved all of the players in the band and Chadwick's performance. He's going to be a strong best actor candidate here. So a big thumbs up for me for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Yeah, Ma Rainey goes in my, you know, in my very, very long list of honorable mentions as well. Anytime you can watch Chadwick Boseman now in one of his final performances, it just breaks your heart at the talent lost there. But, you know, it does feel like a play to me, and very much like Fences did, where I appreciated the acting and the dialogue, but it felt like I was watching a stage play. And to me, that's just not my favorite genre, not the kind of entertainment that I'm generally seeking out in films. But and even when I'm going to Broadway, I don't generally pick out a play. I generally go for the musicals. So, you know, that's why Ma Rainey didn't make my top 10, but it is a very good film. And we'll definitely be hearing more about that in awards time.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, number six. Plays and musicals. Yeah. So in my number six is the Broadway musical turned movie Hamilton, with an honorable mention to The Prom.
Oh,
because
God. Don't even put
I
it
was
in the
missing. Well, I throw it as a side because the same reason that I like The Prom is why I loved Hamilton when it was put out for us on July 4th. It was critic proof. It was one of those ones that was just providing Broadway fans and others this joyful intermission to the pandemic. And it is essentially a stage production of Hamilton on film, whereas The Prom was adapted for the big screen and featured these big names, Meryl Streep, Nicole Kidman. But both of these, and Hamilton in particular, just brought a bit of Broadway into my home while I was waiting for a return to the real deal in New York City. And it was a moment, you know, a movie moment for people. And it brought a lot of people together, sort of those watch parties. And so I just appreciate what it was able to do at a very tough time.
Yeah, I had not seen Hamilton before this film. I hadn't seen it on Broadway, and I hadn't listened to, you know, the cast ensemble singing on Spotify or anything, but I really, really enjoyed watching this. I mean, I think the first half is far stronger than the second half. Nothing dragged or anything. It was just a more interesting bits of music and story in the first half for me. But yeah, Lin-Manuel Miranda, now I see what all the buzz is about. I agree. It's a wonderful film.
Great. So what's yours?
Now we're getting to the point of my list where I would stop. Yeah, I can't really interchange them anymore. Now, this one's set. It's probably not going to go anywhere after this. So number six is one that you're really going to hear a lot of from Oscar time that you haven't seen yet, Nomadland. starring Frances McDormand, and directed by Chloe Zhao, who did The Rider, if you saw The Rider. After losing everything in the Great Recession, a woman embarks on a journey through the American West, living as a van-dwelling modern-day nomad. And this, you know, introduces us to what I guess is a full-on nomad culture that I was very unaware of. But apparently a lot of people, you know, they get in their vans and Winnebagos and some in their Priuses, and they journey and they wander and they meet up. You know, their big thing is, I'll meet you, I'll see you down the road. It's never a goodbye. And it's an arduous life. There's a lot of things to do, to take care of, safety-wise, finance-wise, but it's a fascinating look at a subculture that was displaced by the economy. They are itinerant workers. Frances McDormand is going to get a lot of attention to this as Fern, and don't be, you know, scared or mad that you haven't seen it yet. It doesn't release widely until February, so you got another about 6 weeks to wait for this, but Nomadland, put it on your radar.
Yeah, I mean, I finally watched it last week, and I understand what the buzz is about. I mean, Frances McDormand to me is just always good, and it's very beautifully shot, and but it feels like a hybrid documentary and drama. And I think they actually used a lot of real folks from out in that nomad land who lived this lifestyle. So it was interesting to me. It was a very interesting film, but I wasn't feeling the love. I see this at the top of a lot of people's top 10 lists. And for me, it was good. It would be an honorable mention one, but it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. It really is a style and a type of film that is not necessarily going to provide the kind of cinematic escape some people want. Although it did make me yearn for a road trip. I just was like, wow, if I could just, I kind of got a better understanding for the motivations for packing up, totally downsizing, hopping in an RV and just crisscrossing the country.
Actually kind of turned me off of it. I said, no, I'll stay in my house.
I do like running water, I got to say, but I did want to hit the road, if nothing else.
All right, now we're going to get into the heavy hitters, Hannah, your top five, number five.
So my number five is really my only other tie, just to
good Lord,
warn you, because again, it was more about connecting. I couldn't choose between these two because they were very, I had different reasons for liking them, but they fell within the same genre, and that is romantic drama. So earlier I talked about the romantic comedy that that was nice to have with the gallery film, but for romantic dramas, there's one that kind of slipped the radar from a lot of people called Ordinary Love, and then which actually came out back in February, and then there's one that's out now called Sylvie's Love. And so Ordinary Love and Sylvie's Love actually are romantic dramas that tie for my number five. Ordinary Love was Liam Neeson and Leslie Manville, two like really, really fine actors, playing this long married couple, and they were navigating a diagnosis of cancer. It takes place over the course of a year. And to me, these two just delivered this masterclass in very quiet and meaningful performances. And while the subject matter itself was quite difficult, it's not one of those depressingly heavy films. It's more of an observational drama and love story that just exuded believability and the whole in sickness and in health thing. So I just remember really, really appreciating Ordinary Love for that. Sylvie's Love is a very stylistic love story set in late 1950s Harlem. And it's the starts and stops and restarts of a relationship between an aspiring jazz saxophonist and an aspiring TV producer. And that also just a really well done story. So if you're looking for a romantic drama, Ordinary Love, Sylvie's Love, both fine choices.
Yeah, I have nothing to add here because I haven't seen either of them. I don't even remember Ordinary Love. That must have been so long ago. That has just gone from my radar. But Sylvie's Love is a recent addition to Amazon Prime Video, I believe. But I can only take your word for it, Hannah.
You'll catch up with it because I think, I don't know, it will be tough for it to kind of find any love in award season, but I do think it floats to the top for current romantic dramas that are out there.
My number five is probably the year's best comedy. And it's, you know, every now and then I just latch on to a film that many other people don't. I've seen this on a handful, just a handful of other top 10 lists. And it was more of a festival darling than anything. But number five is The Climb, written and co-written and directed by Michelangelo Covino. Climb is kind of like a bromance, but a terrible kind of an abusive friendship between two guys that spans over many years. You know, what do you do if you have to tell your best friend that you slept or are sleeping with his fiance? You tell him on the incline of a bike ride. It's beautiful. He can't catch you. And it's that wry comedy that just permeates throughout the rest of the film that I just could not help smiling at and chuckling at in the absurdest situations that pop up between these two guys. It's just, I still can't smile. I can't stop smiling about this movie. It's so funny. So thank you for making me smile and laugh to The Climb in 2020.
I had forgotten about The Climb. So I do remember that that you really liked it. And I liked it too. It was very quirky. So definitely a Charlie comedy for sure. And so, yeah, no, that's a good one. That's quite unique to you, I think. I haven't seen it on too many other lists, but definitely is a hidden gem to look for if you're looking for some quirky comedy. My number four is a repeat because you already put it on your list, and it is, my four is Sound of Metal. I just found it to be such a unique film. The punk metal drummer played by Riz Ahmed. I thought he gave an awards-worthy performance. Supporting actor Paul Racy as the Tough Love program director at the rehab facility for deaf addicts, sound design, a lot of pieces of Sound of Metal just are really just fascinating and unique. And so I think hopefully it will get some awards love for some of those kinds of, I don't think it's necessarily, it's not like a best picture kind of thing, but the individual pieces, the performance of Riz Ahmed, the performance of Paul Racy, the, you know, some of that, the sound design, I think that will all come into play. So I think we both liked it. It's on both our lists. That says a lot.
It does say a lot. That is a key clue. My number four throws a lot of top 10 lists for a loop. People don't know what to do with it. The director, Steve McQueen, who, you know, won a whole bunch of Oscars in 2013 for 12 Years a Slave, he made five, call them short films for Amazon, and he combined together, he calls them Small Acts. So some people put the entire five episodes of Small Acts as, this is my number whatever this year, Small Acts. You won't see it at Oscar time because he's submitting it for TV awards, so it will sweep the Emmys and Golden Globes in the television categories, but I'm particularly highlighting episode two, which is what most people are highlighting. Lovers Rock is my number four. It takes place in a single evening at a house party in the 1980s, the early 80s, in West London. It's a whole bunch of intertwined kind of couples, relationships, dancing, you know, against a background of, you know, a little violence, some romance, and a whole bunch of music. And it is hypnotic. It is fascinating. I can't, immediately when this ended, I wanted to just press repeat and watch it again. It was so fascinating to watch this. And all they are, you know, most of it, 80% of it, it's just couples dancing in the middle of the room, and but it's how it's filmed and shot. It's I can't really put into words what it is about Lover's Rock that is driving critics mad for it, but there's a reason. There's just this atmosphere, this tone that Lover's Rock is just connecting with people, and it got me. It connected with me, and I've got nothing in common with 1980s, you know, West London minorities, but it got me on my number four.
No, that's interesting because I have not seen any of those yet. And I really was not going to, only because I was aware that they were probably going into that TV realm. I just had too many other films to watch. but yeah, hopefully at some point, maybe I'll catch up on some of those. And I guess if you say Lover's Rock is a good one, Artie Chick reviewed one of the others. So there was another one, something with an axe.
It's all small acts.
They're all small acts. And so I forgot which one she reviewed. But yeah, I definitely have heard good things. And so I will try and put it on my list for when there's post-Oscar downtime. All right, we're going into the top three. Woohoo! So my number three is Minari. And that is getting a lot of, buzz because it's really a beautifully shot and very moving film. It's the story of a Korean-American family. They move from California to this small farm in Arkansas, sort of in search of the American dream. It's a very family-friendly drama, and we just simply don't have many of those. And that's really the main reason that it floats so high on my list is because I do think, we need every once in a while just a good movie that families can really watch together that just hits upon some good themes and is just really well done. And so I love the grandmother in Minari. There's just just enough humor to kind of really help keep you engaged. So Minari is my number three.
I really liked Minari. I didn't love it. I did like the grandmother. You probably see her come Oscar time. A lot of people are confused thinking that this is a foreign film, and it's not. Even though the majority of it's in Korean, the writer director is full up American, speaks with an American accent and everything, but always born and bred in America. But so it's not a foreign Korean film at all. It's an American film. It's about the American dream. There's really something in there for everybody, even though none of us are South Korean immigrants per se from California to Arkansas. You can still identify with the family situation and the struggle. So yeah, Minari is definitely worth anybody's time. Certainly. Number three, Promising Young Woman, Carey Mulligan's star vehicle, which should earn her an Oscar Best Actress nomination at least. A young woman, Cassandra, is traumatized by a tragic event in her past, in her case, medical school, of which she dropped out of, and she is seeking a very peculiar form of vengeance against those who have wronged her and her friends in the past. She has an interesting hobby on the weekends. She will act severely inebriated and wait for her white knight to rescue her and take her home. But if they do not take her home and they try to take advantage of the situation, she has ways to confront them about, maybe you are not such a nice guy, sir. So, very interesting story I've never seen before, but a strong supporting character, especially Alison Brie, Adam Brody, Bo Burnham, who we know more as a director than an actor. A fascinating story that I cannot shake, Hannah. It's still at the forefront of my mind.
Yeah, I keep waiting. I'm waiting for more people to see it so we can really talk about it more. And I agree. It's a wonderful film. My number two is going to be the last one that makes you squirm. But only not because I think you'll necessarily disagree with the what's behind it, but because I could not come up. You put Boy State onto your list. I felt that there were so many documentaries that I really enjoyed this year that I couldn't pick. There were just too many that were just all really good for different reasons. And so I made my number two documentaries. And so from John Lewis, Good Trouble, The Fight about the ACLU, Collective, The Social Dilemma, Desert One, The Bee Gees, Springsteen, Boy State, Mayor, Mucho Mucho Amor, Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President, A Thousand Cuts, even Tiger King. There were just a swarm of really fascinating stories to watch. And so to me, this was the biggest year in recent memory where I just felt that there was just one documentary after another that was just as strong as any narrative film that we were watching in certain weeks. And so I decided to just make my number two a devotion to the documentaries that came out this year, because I think there was just something for everyone and a lot of interesting things to learn.
That's true of any year. Documentaries are great every year, and that's the tough part to make about a top 10, but that's what you got to do. You have to make choices, 1 through 10.
Why?
So to put an entire genre...
Year?
Because that's what you do. That's the rules, man.
This is a year
man.
Where
it's
I don't
tough.
Think
Otherwise,
I had to make choices. I think my choice was to actually do whatever the heck I wanted with my top 10 list, because that's just the kind of year this was.
And there are tiers within those documentaries. Yes, there's the Boise State tier, along with Collective, you know, the really strong heavy hitters. And then you mentioned some that are way down that cliff.
Yeah, they're way down that cliff, but they're different. But some people will really enjoy some of those smaller ones too, where, you know, and when you think back to just how Tiger King, I mean, it's not that I'm at all promoting the fact that Tiger King did so ridiculously well early on the pandemic, where people were just binging it. But it just goes to show you that these, you know, there's something to be said for really just watching and learning about these other things that are happening with real people and real stories. And, you know, John Lewis, Good Trouble is one that just, you know, when we did watch it, and it was right around the time that he died, and it served as this great homage to him. And so I just, to me, that was part of this particular year and these documentaries playing a very different kind of role than they have in the past. And Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President, I mean, that was a surprise. And so many of these were just really unique surprises or just inspiring in a certain way. And I just wanted to be able to give a nod to the genre this year.
I'm looking at you askance through the microphone.
I know. I wish I could see it through the computer screen, but I can't.
All right. Number two is a first time feature film, obviously made on a shoestring budget. The Vast of Night. One night in New Mexico in the late 1950s, a switchboard operator and radio DJ discover a strange audio frequency which could change the future for everyone. I loved this film. It was so immersive. I mean, I didn't live in the late 1950s, but man, I'm pretty sure that's what the late 1950s looked like. And it has these really long, writer-director Andrew Patterson has these really long takes, like going through a high school gymnasium or walking through town as they're just talking about the future and what the future could hold. And maybe there's some sort of alien activity going on up in the skies. Maybe there's not. Let's find out what it is. What a fascinating, intriguing little movie that could, and it can. Everybody loves this movie, Hannah, especially a certain kind of cinephile. So I love The Vast of Night.
It is. It is a great film for the cinephile crowd. It's you loved it way more than I did. I remember I did watch it. I did find it interesting, but it was not going to crack my top 10. Maybe it cracks my honorable mentions for just those kind of more oddball small films that came out throughout the year. But yeah, I know that Vast of Night was one of your faves. And I actually, which, you know, I'm surprised it's that high up on the list. But then again, not so surprised, because Vast of Night is a Charlie movie. And so, you know, it deserves all your love.
Well, since we know each other so well, I'm not going to ruin it, but I already know you're number one, because I haven't heard it on your list yet.
I know. And that's why I was like, oh, man, I thought we came so close. There was one year where I think we both picked the same number one. And I thought we might actually repeat that. But my number one is your number three. And it is Promising Young Woman. And I picked that because I, too, am still thinking about it. Still thinking about what a wild ride that movie was, and how I want people to see it soon so we can actually really, really, truly talk about it, because we can't. Hopefully by the time our Oscar prediction show rolls around in April, we'll be able to really have a more thorough discussion about what happens in this film. But Carey Mulligan is just amazing in this revenge thriller. It's a revenge movie like none other I've ever seen. And so even though I would normally, you know, be like, how in the world can you and I both sort of have a particular movie float to the top like that for both of us, I knew Promising Young Woman would be on your list. I didn't know where exactly it would fall. But for me, that because it was such a surprise. I mean, like, the movie just shocked me in so many ways, even with just how overall good it was. So I think Carey Mulligan, I think this is going to be one of those ones that once more people see it, will have the potential of doing really well during award season.
Yeah, no problems here. Sometimes your number one annoys me, but there was that one year that we matched, and no problem on this being number one at all. That's a promising woman, such a strong film, and yeah, we can't talk about it. I mean, we can, because it's, you can rent it or see it in theaters or whatever, but spoilers all over this film. You just can't talk about it until the world has figured it out.
Yep.
All right, number one, The Outpost, directed by Rod Lurie, based on the book by Jake Tapper, The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor. We're in Afghanistan. We're in 2009, and we're at Kop Keating, the worst located combat outpost you could ever imagine. It's at the bottom, in a valley, at the bottom of multiple mountains, where the Taliban can just look down on you and kill you at will. In a strong ensemble cast, but one of those where it's war. So, it's hard to keep track of people, but you learn, okay, there's Scott Eastwood, there's Orlando Bloom, there's Caleb Landry Jones, who I think is probably the year's best supporting actor in this film. I haven't seen it on any top 10 lists. I don't hear it getting any love. I think everybody forgot about The Outpost. But here I am, waving the flag, saying, do not forget about The Outpost. It is visceral. It is violent. This is exactly how Army Enlisted talks to one another. And the battle scenes are absolutely insane. So, number one, with a bullet, pardon the pun, The Outpost.
Wow, I am surprised, because I have actually, though, in recent days, seen The Outpost on quite a few lists, more so as honorable mentions or further down on a list. But you definitely like this film a lot more than I did, but it's mostly because I'm just not a big war movie buff. And this was very much a war movie. And I could not tell any of those key players apart. I remember watching and thinking, who is that? And who's that one? And which one was that? So I thought The Outpost was good, but I would not have made it. I would not have put it in my top 10.
And that's a standard response for both of us, I believe, to each other's lists.
That's right. No, but I mean, I think that it's good, though. And you have a special... You have a special connection to that region and to that setting, and so it speaks to you on a different plane. And the same thing is with a lot of the films that I put in my list. They speak to me for a different reason, and so it's good that we're not going to necessarily overlap all that much. But that I think I've learned to expand my horizons over these past several years to appreciate a lot more different types of films. I can't even imagine before we were doing Cinema Clash that I ever would have watched Extraordinary. And so I think it's great that there's that opportunity to sort of get some things onto these lists to remind us that we see a lot. and so when we watch that many films, There are going to be reasons that different ones resonate with each of us.
I'm looking it up as we were talking, and I think the year we matched for number one was 2017, when we both picked Three Billboards.
Ah, yes. Wow. There you go. That was a good one.
That was a good movie.
Yeah, and that was another year I remember, though, with Three Billboards. That was a definitive number one for me. And that's why this has been a tough year where I didn't have that definitive. So that would be another one when I know you cringed at my earlier list referencing La La Land and Star Is Born and things like and Green Book. But Three Billboards was definitely that one that year that I loved. But I think Promising Young Woman is close to matching that same sort of feeling that I came out of Three Billboards with, in terms of that was unexpected, that was different, that was really good.
Yeah, and remember, most of these, almost 95% of these, we didn't see on the big screen as intended. I bet watching Promising Young Woman with an audience and gasping together and being shocked together and losing our minds together would have created just a different outcome. Who knows where it would have ended on my list then. But, you know, just watching it alone on your television, it's just a different experience. That's a movie I want to see with 100 other people.
Yeah, no, I miss that. And I do think that that part of my list choices are reflecting the fact that I was watching by myself on a small screen, not as intended. And I do respond differently when you're able to do a debrief even right after films while you screen them with more people. And not being able to have that really does, I think, impact my ultimate enjoyment of a film.
Well, there we go. Most of, we have some matches. The honorable mentions matches. Oh, just very quickly, honorable mentions. I don't have that many. The Assistant, Extraordinary, mm-hmm. Beanpole, The Hunt, Cajillionaire, The Gentleman, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, First Cow, and Never Rarely, Sometimes, Always.
And those are all fine choices for honorable mention. And so I will just concur with that because they are all good. And I think I could go on my honorable mention list of films that are sort of of equal weight would probably take another hour and a half. So we'll save that for another time. Maybe we can do an honorable mention only program.
Fair enough.
All right. So thanks for listening to our best of 2020 countdown. Whether you agree, disagree, have a list of your own, please do let us know. You can reach us on Twitter at The Cinema Clash or online at thecinemaclash.com. Till next time, stay safe, wear a mask. When your turn comes, get your shot, and best wishes for a very happy and healthy new year.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.